Simon and Schuster Audio presents The Conquerors, Roosevelt, Truman, and the Destruction of Hitler's Germany, 1941 to 1945, by Michael Beschloss, read by the author.
Als Führer und Kanzler der deutschen Nation und des Reichs melde ich vor der deutschen Geschichte nunmehr den Eintritt meine Heimat in das Deutsche Reich!
25 years ago, American fighting men looked to the statesmen of the world to furnish the work of peace for which they fought and suffered. We failed them. We failed them then. We cannot fail them again and expect the world to survive again.
The armies of liberation today are bringing to an end Hitler's ghastly threat to dominate the world. In the memory of those who have made the supreme sacrifice, we shall not fail.
The Conquerors tells the story of an important American success. During World War II, many Americans had a grim expectation. They felt that even if the Allies won the war, someday the world would have to cope once again with a raging militaristic Germany under some future version of Adolf Hitler. In 1944, there was a survey that asked, "Assuming that Germany loses the war, do you think she will start as soon as possible preparing for another one?" 60% of Americans said yes. Instead, almost 60 years after VE Day, the Germany of today is democratic and peaceful. That success owes much to the wartime leadership of Franklin Roosevelt and that of Harry Truman after Roosevelt's death. While Roosevelt and Truman fought the European War and bargained with their allies, Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin, they had a larger aim than merely defeating the Nazis. They were determined that after victory, the German system that had brought Hitler and his depraved movement should be so transformed that Germany could never again threaten the world. As we'll see, during World War II, neither Roosevelt nor Truman dealt flawlessly with the problems of Germany. But the Conquerors chose that while heroically leading the fight against the Nazis, FDR and Truman also helped to lay the groundwork for post-war Germans to spare themselves and the world a future Adolf Hitler. It concentrates on the American part of the story, especially the largely hidden role of FDR's closest friend in the cabinet, Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, Jr. Morgenthau's horror on learning of the Holocaust compelled him to risk his friendship with the president by demanding that he work to save Jews. Then, obsessed by Germany, he lobbied Roosevelt to support his draconian plan to destroy post-war Germany's factories and mines and let the defeated Germans stew in their own juice. But in the end, Roosevelt was motivated by something else. He knew that Morgenthau's plan was born out of justifiable anger at the Nazis and dread of a revived post-war Germany, but that it would also violate old American traditions of magnanimity. Roosevelt also felt that by fueling German resentment, it might actually create the conditions for another Hitler. History now shows that by destroying a barrier to Soviet power and alienating the Germans from Britain and America, the plan could have also opened the way for the Soviet Union to dominate post-war Europe. By the end of his life, Roosevelt had arrived at a different design. Adopted later by Truman, Roosevelt's design managed to defy whatever menacing ambitions the Soviets had for Europe and give post-war Germans the chance to prove themselves.
The plot to murder Hitler.
Thursday, July 20, 1944, would have been Adolf Hitler's last day on Earth. 6 weeks after D-Day, the United States, Great Britain, and their allies had landed 1 million men in France. the Red Army was marching westward. Hitler was burrowed in at the Wolf's Lair. This was his field headquarters near Rostenburg. It stood in a melancholy, dank East Prussian forest that is now part of Poland. At noon, sitting in a log barracks, Hitler listened to a gloomy report from one of his army chiefs about Germany's retreat on the Eastern Front. In the steamy room, he took off the eyeglasses he vainly refused to use in public. He mopped his forehead with a handkerchief. SS men and stenographers stood around the massive, long oak table like nervous cats. When maps were unfurled, Hitler leaned over them and squinted through a magnifying glass, grimacing at the bad news. Into the room strode a 37-year-old officer named Klaus von Stauffenberg. He was a Bavarian nobleman, with blonde hair and sharp cheekbones. He had lost an eye and seven fingers to an Allied mine in Tunisia while fighting for Germany. Unknown to the Führer or the other two dozen people in the chamber, Stauffenberg was part of a secret, loosely rigged, anti-Hitler conspiracy. Disgusted by what he had heard about Nazi brutality in Russia, Stauffenberg had taught himself how to use his remaining three fingers to set off a bomb. By luck, in July 1944, he was summoned to the Wolf's Lair to help brief Hitler about the Eastern Front. Inside Stauffenberg's briefcase, swaddled in a shirt, was a ticking time bomb. While the army chief droned on, the briefcase was slipped under the table. Leaving his hat and belt behind, as if he were stepping out for a moment, Stauffenberg walked out of the room and left the barracks. About a quarter to one came a loud boom and swirl of blue-yellow flame, followed by black smoke. Outside the barracks, Stauffenberg saw men carry out a stretcher on which lay a body shrouded by what seemed to be Hitler's cloak. Rushing to his car for a getaway flight to Berlin, Stauffenberg presumed that Adolf Hitler was no more. But he was wrong. Striving for a better view of the maps, one of the Führer's aides had pushed the briefcase behind one of the table's massive supports. This act saved Hitler from certain death. Instead, when the smoke cleared, Hitler was still standing. With bloodshot eyes staring out from a soot-blackened face, he tamped down flame from his trousers. His hair stood out in spikes. His ruptured eardrums were bleeding. His right arm dangled numb at his side. After donning a fresh uniform, seemingly exhilarated by his survival, Hitler was almost merry. He chortled to his secretaries, "Once again, everything's turned out well for me. More proof that fate has selected me for my mission." That afternoon, he showed his scorched clothes to the visiting ousted Italian dictator, Benito Mussolini. Hitler said, "Look at my uniform. Look at my burns." He had the uniform sent to his mistress, Eva Braun, for safekeeping, as proof of his historical destiny. It did not take Hitler's men long to discover who had been behind the plot. In Berlin, Stauffenberg and three fellow plotters were arrested. A 5-minute trial in the name of the Führer found them guilty of treason. In a shadowy courtyard, they were hauled before a firing squad. Just before his execution, remembering his country before Hitler, Stauffenberg cried out, "Long live eternal Germany!" An hour after midnight on Friday, July 21, Berlin time, Hitler spoke by radio from the Wolf's Lair. After a burst of military music, he declared, "Fellow members of the German race," he said, "an extremely small clique of ambitious, unscrupulous, and foolish, criminally stupid officers had plotted to kill him and the German high command, a crime that has no equal in German history," he said. "Failure of the plot," he said, "was a clear sign from Providence that I must carry on with my work." After that speech, fearing for his life, Hitler never again spoke in public. By his orders, hundreds of suspected members of the conspiracy were arrested, tortured, and executed. Hitler ordered some of the chief plotters strung up like butchered cattle. A motion picture of their execution was rushed to the Wolf's Lair for his enjoyment. By one account, Hitler and his propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, watched in his private theater. As the shirtless men on the screen swung from piano wire nooses, writhing and dying while their carefully unbelted trousers fell off to reveal them naked. Goebbels had demanded for years that Hitler's enemies be stalked with what he called ice-cold determination. But when he and Hitler watched the ghoulish, flickering images of the lifeless plotters on the screen, it was later said, even the cold-blooded Goebbels had to cover his eyes to keep from passing out. After Hitler finished his speech from the Wolf's Lair, Franklin Roosevelt gave his own radio address from California. Speaking from a radio car at the San Diego Naval Base, he accepted the 1944 Democratic nomination for president. For wartime security reasons, the public was told only that the base was on the Pacific coast. The president was making a 5-week, 14,000-mile military inspection trip of the Pacific coast, Hawaii, and Alaska. His special 9-car railroad caravan had moved slowly to kill time before his arrival in San Diego and spare him from having to sleep at night in a moving train. Secret Service agents had tried to keep Roosevelt's exact whereabouts a secret. For this reason, at every stop, the president and his party were asked to stay aboard the train. But Roosevelt's famous Scotty dog, Falla, had to be taken off to relieve himself. When Pullman porters and ticket takers saw Falla, they knew who was really aboard the train called simply Maine 985. One might have expected Roosevelt to be delighted when he heard the news of a coup that might topple Hitler. If a new post-Hitler government accepted the Allied demand for unconditional surrender, it could save millions of lives. It could also let the Big Three, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, throw Allied forces fully into the war against Japan. But Roosevelt knew that there was also a danger. A new post-Hitler junta would probably demand a negotiated settlement. It might insist that certain members of the German military and government stay in place. If that happened, it would frustrate Roosevelt's declared intention to remake post-war Germany from the ground up so it could never threaten the world again. Told of Hitler's attempted assassination, reporters in San Diego badgered Roosevelt's aides for the president's reaction to the news. The president offered no comment. He knew that whatever he said would be playing with fire. If he publicly welcomed the plot, he might seem to be backing off from the Allied policy of unconditional surrender. If he denounced it, he might seem indifferent to a development that might end the war quickly. If he opposed the plot and it finally succeeded, Stalin would have a better chance to make a deal with a new post-Hitler government that would let the Soviets dominate Europe. Instead, Roosevelt wrote a carefully worded private message to Stalin. It suggested that the plot was encouraging because it showed a Nazi foe in disarray. He wrote, "We have just received news of the difficulties in Germany and especially at Hitler's headquarters. It is all to the good." On Friday evening in Chicago, with Roosevelt's consent, Democrats had chosen Senator Harry Truman of Missouri for vice president. In San Diego, with Truman safely nominated, the president and Falla were driven in darkness to Broadway Pier and piped aboard the heavy cruiser Baltimore, bound for Honolulu. To protect Roosevelt from Japanese attack, the gleaming new ship was escorted by 4 destroyers. The ship followed an unpredictable route and was darkened from sunset to sunrise. During the voyage, sailors had to be stopped from cutting snippets of hair from Falla to send home. Only a full week after Hitler's near assassination did Roosevelt make his first public comment about the plot. As the president sat with reporters on the emerald lawn of the Hawaiian governor's palace, he was excruciatingly careful. He said, "I don't think I know anything more about it than you do. We can all have our own ideas about it." Roosevelt went on to reaffirm the Allied demand for unconditional surrender. He said, "Practically every German denies the fact they surrendered in the last war, but this time they're going to know it." In Moscow, Stalin's propagandists agreed. They said, Hitlerite Germany will be driven to her knees not by insurgent officers, but by ourselves and our allies. Roosevelt agreed with Stalin and Churchill that the paramount question left by the European War would be what happened to Germany. Roosevelt thought a lasting peace would depend on whether he and Churchill could maintain their friendship with the Soviet Union, and whether Germany could be so transformed that it could never endanger the world again. But how? Even with the European war rushing toward climax, and Allied armies about to pierce the German border, the president refused to commit himself. He told exasperated aides that much would depend on what we and the Allies find when we get into Germany, and we're not there yet. With his extravagant confidence and his ability to master events, Franklin Roosevelt was keeping his options open until the final possible moment.
Unconditional surrender.
No other American president has had more early experience on German soil than Franklin Roosevelt. After his elderly father suffered a heart attack, his parents brought their only son to Germany 8 times, where they took the cure at the famous health resort of Bad Nauheim. During Franklin's first visit in 1891 at the age of 9, he was enrolled for 6 weeks in a local school, mainly to improve his German. Rather amusing, wrote his mother Sarah, but I doubt if he learns much. The Roosevelt stayed in a British-owned hotel called the Villa Britannia. Anglophile, partial to French culture, they considered most Germans crude and inferior. Sarah complained about dining with German swine. The Germany that Franklin first encountered had been created 20 years earlier, after the Franco-Prussian War, by the Iron Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. It was 20 ancient kingdoms, free cities, and provinces forged into a single Reich. In 1890, Bismarck was fired by Kaiser Wilhelm II, who spoke of Germany's destiny to rule. Years later, as president, Roosevelt liked to believe that his own early German experience gave him a special understanding of German politics and psychology. He recalled German schoolchildren chattering about the inevitable war with France and the building of the Reich into the greatest world power. He insisted that on his first visit there, Germany was not a military nation. Politics was local and there was decent family life. But by the late 1890s, he recalled, boys and girls wore uniforms and were taught to march. Roosevelt shared his mother's social prejudices. In 1905, during his honeymoon with his new bride Eleanor, Roosevelt wrote his mother from a German spa that by a show of severity, he had arranged to sit as far as possible from where Germans dined, which he described as 4 long pigsties. During World War II, while waging war against Hitler, Roosevelt told friends and family colorful stories, possibly exaggerated or imaginary, about his youthful brushes with German authoritarianism. In one tale, he claimed that while peddling with his tutor through southern Germany, he had been arrested 4 times in a single day, for stealing cherries, running over a goose, wheeling his bicycle into a train station waiting room, and riding into a town after sunset. Roosevelt's more serious education on Germany came during World War I. When fighting broke out in Europe in 1914, he was a 32-year-old Assistant Secretary of the Navy. After American entry into the war in April 1917, Roosevelt gave speeches against Kaiserism and Prussianism. He insisted that Germans were a misguided people, subjected to the rule of the military caste, and led along a path they could not understand. In the summer of 1918, touring battlefields in France and Belgium, he wrote in his diary of stolid, stupid German prisoners and the little pile of dead Boche that offended our sensitive noses. Roosevelt insisted that if England, France, and the United States did not plunge deep into Germany, the Germans would convince themselves that they had not really lost the war. Under the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, Germany was ordered to slash its military. It was told to demilitarize the eastern bank of the Rhine, surrender its colonies, give land to Belgium, France, Denmark, and Poland, accept absolute blame for World War I, and pay the Allies reparations for damage caused by the war, ultimately billions of dollars. 5 years after the end of World War I, in 1923, General Pershing, once the Supreme Commander, complained that the Allies had never made sure the Germans knew they were beaten. He said, "Now it will have to be done all over again." The French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau, had insisted on much of this over the objections of President Woodrow Wilson. Roosevelt agreed. In the 1920s, as a lawyer and private businessman recovering from polio, which he contracted at the age of 39, he felt that Versailles had been both too hard and too soft. He felt that it burdened Germany with financial and other obligations it would only resent and could never fulfill, and he feared that it didn't do enough to keep Germans from wishing for war and being able to wage it. He watched gloomily as his worst fears unfolded. The Weimar democracy sagged under hyperinflation, war debt, and reparations, resentment over the harshness of the Versailles Treaty, and the conviction fanned by Hitler that betrayers of the German military had held back Germany from its historical destiny. Roosevelt thought Wilson should have insisted that the victors occupy Germany. He thought that the Germans should have been trained to give up their old ambitions for dictatorship, a strong military, and a world empire. Roosevelt saw Hitler come to power shortly before his inauguration in 1933. The new president realized earlier than most Americans that during his term in office, the United States might be forced to pay for Wilson's mistakes. In January 1943, Roosevelt seized the opportunity to practice what he preached. After a bumpy 48-hour flight in a Pan American Clipper, his first air journey as president, he landed in the old Moroccan port city of Casablanca to meet with Winston Churchill. Coping with the German thrust into the Western Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin stayed home. Stalin was lambasting his allies in public for their refusal to open a promised second front against Hitler, the invasion of Western Europe that would relieve German pressure on the Red Army. At Casablanca, Roosevelt and Churchill agreed to issue a public statement that the Allies were resolved to pursue the war to the bitter end. Over luncheon, Roosevelt suggested that they use the phrase unconditional surrender. Churchill had his private doubts, but he was so dependent on Roosevelt's support of England that he strained to show enthusiasm. "Perfect," he said. "I can just see how Goebbels and the rest of them will squeal." Roosevelt said, "It's just the thing for the Russians. Uncle Joe might have made it up himself." At a press conference, Roosevelt told reporters, "Peace can come to the world only by the total elimination of German and Japanese war power. The Allies," he said, "would fight to destroy the philosophies in those countries based on conquest and the subjugation of other people." He declared that Casablanca should be called the Unconditional Surrender Meeting. Churchill chimed in, "Hear, hear." However, the Prime Minister did not quite believe what he was saying. He did not want to quarrel with Roosevelt at Casablanca, but he was pessimistic that unconditional surrender would placate Stalin. More than Roosevelt, Churchill worried that unconditional surrender might cause the Germans to struggle harder against the Allies and prolong the war. Nor did Churchill share Roosevelt's utopian aspirations to transform German society. Suspicious of Stalin, he knew that the only bulwark against Soviet domination of post-war Europe might be Germany. Stalin was told about Roosevelt and Churchill's unconditional surrender declaration just as the Red Army turned back the Germans at Stalingrad. Stalin feared, even more than Churchill, that the unconditional surrender demand would unite and steel the German people against the Allies. Stalin was also reluctant to say things in public that might jaundice post-war Germans against the Soviet Union. He had never stopped dreaming of a communist Germany, or at least that Germany, with its industrial might and skilled manpower, might be made to help modernize Russia. He was also determined that millions of Soviet soldiers should not have lost their lives in World War II, only to be faced with a hostile German nation. He was still in a cold fury over Hitler's surprise invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941. So Stalin's approach to a post-war Germany was to play a double game. Publicly, he would avoid the anti-German rhetoric heard from Roosevelt and Churchill. Instead, he would subtly telegraph to Germans that the Soviets might be the most friendly of their potential conquerors. Privately, Stalin would demand that his allies commit themselves to draconian methods to shatter post-war German power. In the summer of 1943, Stalin formed what amounted to his own German government in exile. He called it the National Committee for a Free Germany. Stalin claimed that the Free Germany Committee was intended to reduce German resistance. But many American and British planners feared with good reason that its actual purpose was to serve as the political spearhead of Soviet influence in post-war Germany. William Bullitt, who had served as Roosevelt's ambassador to the Soviet Union, warned the president that Stalin's objective is to set up a Soviet Quisling government in Germany. After an Allied victory, he wrote, the United States must stop the flow of the red amoeba and keep the Bolsheviks from replacing the Nazis as masters of Europe. At the White House, in March 1943, British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden warned Roosevelt that at the end of the war, Stalin, with his deep-seated mistrust of the Germans, would insist on dismemberment of Germany. He said that unless Roosevelt and Churchill reached an understanding with Stalin about post-war Germany, then either Germany will go communist or there will be out-and-out anarchy.
50,000 Germans must be shot.
By the fall of 1943, Stalin was growing all the more impatient for the Anglo-Americans to open the second front they had pledged. That September, he was outraged when Churchill and Roosevelt froze the Soviets out of the unconditional surrender by the new Italian government of General Pietro Badoglio, who had deposed Mussolini. Roosevelt asked his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, to fly to Moscow for a meeting with the Soviet Foreign Minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, along with Anthony Eden, Churchill's Foreign Secretary. Physically exhausted, Hull suffered from diabetes and tuberculosis, which he concealed. He was so claustrophobic that he had never flown on an airplane before. But he was so thrilled to be invited to make the journey that without asking his internist or his wife, he quickly told the president yes. For years, Hull, an old ex-congressman from Tennessee, had operated less as Roosevelt's Secretary of State than as his aggrieved chaperone. With grace and loyalty, Hull had tried to provide structure to a president prone to chatting about unconventional ideas and who made Hull's life miserable by flagrantly circumventing him with a ceaseless parade of personal envoys. After Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt had assigned post-war planning for Germany and the rest of the world to Hull's State Department. From the president's point of view, somebody had to do it while he attended to the more urgent problems of winning the war. Hull's planners imagined a strong, self-supporting post-war German economy that would help restore sanity to its society and empower the rebuilding of Europe. Free trade would buttress German democracy and stability. At the White House on Wednesday, October 5, Hull told the president that post-war Germany should remain unified, although stripped of East Prussia, with other minor border changes. He said, imposed partition would be little short of a disaster, both for Germany and for us. Roosevelt disagreed. He reminded Hull that he had traveled and studied in Germany. He could speak German and he knew the country better than Hull did. Maybe his memories were too old to be valid, he said, but to his mind, the only way to prevent another war was to partition Germany. The immediate post-war period would be trial and error, he told Hull. But first they should slice Germany into three or more states, bound only by a system of common services, and strip those new states of all military activities and armament industries. East Prussia should be separated from Germany, and all dangerous elements of the population forcibly removed. He also said that post-war Germans should provide reparations to those countries that were Hitler's victims. Not money, as after World War I, but equipment and manpower. Roosevelt was drawing as usual from his half-remembered experiences in Germany. He showed little understanding, for instance, of the difference between the autocracies of the last Kaiser and Hitler, or of Prussia, which he incorrectly viewed as the militaristic nucleus of Nazi evil. It was not Prussia, but Bavaria, that was the seedbed for Nazism. Hull did not know it, since Roosevelt did not allow him to read the pertinent cables and documents, but Roosevelt's first priority at the moment was to mollify Stalin, whom he presumed to be interested in German reparations and dismemberment. He wanted Hull to let Stalin know that, even though opening the Second Front might take a little longer, on post-war Germany, his American ally was sympathetic. After coughing up a considerable amount of blood during his air journey, Hull arrived in Moscow on Tuesday, October 18, 1943. At Roosevelt's instance, he told Stalin's foreign minister, Molotov, that after the war, Prussia, the taproot of all evil, should be severed from Germany. And certainly German power should be decentralized. Molotov replied that the Soviets would endorse any measure to render Germany harmless in the future. Hull made other offers stemming from what he and Roosevelt thought to be Stalin's demand for a hard peace with post-war Germany. He said the Allies should dismantle the German military and stop the production of arms, including the materials that were essential to make them. Post-war Germany must offer reparations in goods and services for its physical damage to the Soviet Union and other countries. This was no small enticement to the Soviets, who were eager to rebuild. Hull also proposed that after Germany's defeat, the country be jointly occupied by all three Allied armies and run by an Allied Control Council. Under a Bill of Rights, the Council would help create a democratic German government that would provide the Germans with a tolerable standard of living. Molotov said that Hull's ideas sounded promising as long as they were a minimum and not a maximum proposal. When the discussion turned to German war criminals, Hull spoke up with untypical vehemence. He said, "If I had my way, I would take Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo and their arch-accomplices and bring them before a drumhead court-martial. And at sunrise on the following day, there would occur an historic incident." Molotov and his aides applauded and cheered. At the end of the conference, Hull, Eden, and Molotov issued what soon became known as the Moscow Declaration on War Crimes. Using language drafted beforehand by Churchill, they decreed that Germans accused of atrocities would be sent back to the countries in which their abominable deeds were done. The three victors would jointly try major war criminals whose offenses were not restricted to one country. One purpose of the Moscow Declaration was to discourage Germans from committing new atrocities as Hitler's armies retreated. It warned that the Allies would pursue them to the uttermost ends of the earth. The Moscow Conference had been planned as a prelude to the first meeting between Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill in Soviet-occupied Tehran. When Hull returned to Washington, he found the president looking forward to his meeting with Stalin with the enthusiasm of a boy. Stalin had demanded that the meeting be held at a place of his own convenience. With a not too subtle reminder that the Soviet Union was carrying the lion's share of the war against Germany, he told Roosevelt that he could not leave his military post and threatened to defer the promised conference until after Roosevelt and Churchill opened their second front. On Saturday morning, November 13, 1943, Roosevelt boarded the USS Iowa on Chesapeake Bay. Although Hull had not embarrassed him in Moscow, the president left him home. Conferring aboard ship with his chiefs of staff, Roosevelt drew three lines across a National Geographic map of Germany. "Practically speaking," he said, "there should be three German states after the war. These would evolve out of the three zones occupied by the Americans, British, and Soviets." The president said that at the end of the European War, there would definitely be a race for Berlin. He said the United States must be ready to put its divisions into Berlin as soon as possible so that no Russians could seize Berlin before the Anglo-Americans could get there. Roosevelt told the chiefs that after victory in Europe, he expected to field an occupation force of about 1 million American troops. The Army Chief of Staff, General George Marshall, asked him how long American soldiers would stay in Europe. "For at least 1 year," said Roosevelt. "Maybe two." The president arrived in Tehran on Saturday, November 27, 1943. At the Soviet embassy the next afternoon, Stalin was clearly uneasy at his first encounter with Roosevelt. To set him at ease, the president offered him a cigarette. "The doctors don't allow it," said Stalin. Roosevelt replied, "Doctors should be obeyed." To start the talks on the right footing, Roosevelt opened debate on an Anglo-American invasion of Europe for May 1944. That evening, over an American dinner of steak and baked potatoes, Stalin told Roosevelt and Churchill that they were too lax about post-war Germany. How could they ever reform a people so blindly obedient? He recalled that during a Leipzig visit in 1907, he had watched 200 Germans miss an important mass meeting because there was no one on the train platform to punch their tickets. To the president's surprise, Stalin badgered him about unconditional surrender. He said it was welding the Germans together and costing Allied lives. He said, "Holding out specified terms for surrender, no matter how harsh, would hasten the day of German capitulation." Anxious not to quarrel, Roosevelt changed the subject. Referring to the German word for empire, he said it was very important not to leave in the German mind the concept of the Reich. "The very word should be stricken from the language," he said. Stalin said, "It is not enough to eliminate the word. The very Reich itself must be rendered impotent, so as never again to plunge the world into war." Not long after this, Roosevelt suddenly fell ill. With his face turning green and sweat pouring from his chin, he lifted a shivering hand to his forehead and was wheeled quickly out of the room. Roosevelt was suffering from his arduous trip, but some of the Americans in the room were terrified that their chief had been poisoned. After Roosevelt's departure, Stalin sat down on a sofa with Churchill and warned him that Germany had every possibility of recovering from this war. He warned that the Germans were talented people and could easily threaten the world again in 15 or 20 years. Churchill agreed. He said, "If that happened, we would have betrayed our soldiers." But in their conversation, the Prime Minister let on that he did not agree with Roosevelt's insistence that there was no difference between Hitler and the German people. "During wartime," he said, "you never distinguish between the enemy's leaders and its people." But he and Stalin must recognize, in truth, that this war was largely the fault of the German leaders. Churchill felt that the Allies could change the German people with a generation of self-sacrificing, toil, and education. Listening to Churchill merely confirmed Stalin's view that with a wary eye on Soviet power in the post-war world, Churchill was privately soft on Germany. He crisply told the Prime Minister that nothing he had suggested was enough to solve the German problem. On Monday afternoon, with Roosevelt feeling better, the meeting resumed. Roosevelt described his hope for a post-war system of four policemen: the Soviet Union, Britain, America, and China, and a United Nations organization that would protect the world against Germany and Japan. That evening, Stalin hosted a dinner of borscht and fish. He said that his attitude was that if Germany moves a muscle, she will be rapidly stopped. He said, "At least 50,000 and perhaps 100,000 of the German command staff must be physically liquidated." Then he raised his glass and said, "I propose a salute to the swiftest possible justice for all Germany's war criminals. Justice before a firing squad. I drink to our unity in killing them as quickly as we capture them. All of them. There must be at least 50,000. Churchill was deeply disturbed by what Stalin said. He replied, "The British people will never stand for such mass murder. I will not be a party to any butchery in cold blood." Churchill said, "War criminals must pay, but he would not agree to execute soldiers who had fought for their country." He said, "I would rather be taken out in the garden here and now and be shot myself than sully my country's honor by such infamy." Roosevelt said, "As usual, it seems to be my function to mediate this dispute." In jest, he asked them to compromise on a smaller number, say 49,500. One of the guests at the dinner was the president's son, Elliot, a reconnaissance pilot based in England. Elliot raised his glass and said, "Russian, American, and British soldiers will settle the issue for most of those 50,000 in battle. And I hope that those 50,000 war criminals will be taken care of, but many hundreds of thousands more Nazis as well." Stalin rose to his feet, gave Elliot a bear hug, and clinked glasses with him. Outraged, Churchill addressed the president's son. He said, "Much as I love you, Elliot, I cannot forgive you for making such a dastardly statement. How dare you say such a thing?" Churchill stalked away from the table, but Stalin chased after him, grabbed his shoulders, and said he had only been kidding. But when the prime minister returned to his rooms that night after dinner, his doctor, Lord Moran, noted that he had fallen into one of his black depressions. With his understanding of history and the vicissitudes of national power, Churchill predicted that one day there might be a war with the Russians more bloody than that with Germany. He said, "I want to sleep for billions of years. Stupendous issues are unfolding before our eyes, and we are only specks of dust that have settled in the night on the map of the world." On Wednesday evening, December 1, Roosevelt told Churchill and Stalin that the question before them was whether or not to split up Germany. Determined to prove that he agreed with Stalin that post-war Germany should be shattered, he upped the ante from 3 German states to 5. Churchill warned that even if Roosevelt succeeded in dividing Germany, sooner or later they will reunite into one nation. "The main thing," he said, "is to keep Germany divided, if only for 50 years. Stalin said that whatever the Allies did, the Germans would always want to reunite. He said that the victors of World War II must keep the strength to beat the Germans if they ever tried to forcibly reunite and start once again down the path of a new war. Roosevelt sided with Stalin. He said, "Germany was less dangerous to civilization when it was 107 provinces. Churchill told his allies that he hoped that they would not go to that extreme.
On the back of an envelope.
By Wednesday, January 12, 1944, Franklin Roosevelt was back at the White House. He was suffering from what the doctors called influenza, caught during his Tehran journey. In the presidential bedchamber, propped up in his old mahogany bed, surrounded by naval prints and family pictures, Roosevelt thrust out his hand and greeted General Dwight Eisenhower. He had just named Ike to be Supreme Commander of Operation Overlord, the Anglo-American invasion of Northern Europe. Stalin asked who would lead the great invasion. The president said he had not yet decided. Stalin had replied that therefore the British and Americans must not be serious. Roosevelt got the message. While stopping in Tunis on the way back to Washington, he had told Eisenhower that he would be the commander. Roosevelt was so secretive about Tehran that he didn't confide to Ike his discussions with Stalin and Churchill about dismembering Germany. Eisenhower pleaded against dividing the conquered state into 3 occupation zones. He said, "Let a single commander and an allied military government run all of Germany." He said that would be simpler and more likely to ensure that the Red Army would behave. Roosevelt assured him that he could handle the Russians. He encouraged his Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, to scotch the earlier notion of an Anglo-American-Soviet joint occupation force. "Instead," said Roosevelt, "let each country appoint a military governor to run its own occupation zone." At Tehran, the Big Three had asked the newly established three-power European Advisory Commission, the EAC, to suggest zones for Germany. Roosevelt thought of the EAC as something that would buy time and get the Soviets into the habit of consulting the West on post-war questions. The American commissioner, Ambassador to London John Wynant, considered himself not Hull's, but the president's man. At the EAC, Wynant did not submit State Department and other proposals that he knew had been drafted in ignorance of Roosevelt's tough private talk about Germany. In London, on the Commission's opening day in January 1944, The British member, Sir William Strang, proposed dividing Germany into a northeastern Soviet zone, a northwestern British zone, and a southwestern American zone. 110 miles inside the Soviet zone, Berlin would be jointly occupied by all three powers, and unlike the zones, administered by a combined Allied Control Council. Unbeknownst to the Anglo-Americans, Stalin had actually been thinking of a proposal that would have been even more generous to the West. Soviet archives opened in the 1990s include a draft document that would have had the Soviet zone extend no further west than the Elbe River. When Roosevelt was told of the zones agreed upon by the British and Soviets, he was irritated. He said the zones must conform with what I decided upon months ago. But Hull had no idea what the president meant. He suggested that perhaps it would be helpful for him to see the secret records of the Tehran conversations. But the president refused. He did not trust Hull. The chiefs of staff, of course, knew all about Tehran. They had dug up the National Geographic map that Roosevelt had scribbled on while sailing for Tehran and translated it into a formal proposal. When Wynat saw the map, he was astonished. The proposed zones would cut crudely across German geography and existing administrative boundaries. The American zone would include 46% of German territory. For their years of blood and sacrifice, the Soviets would get a measly 20%. When Wynat presented the proposal to the EAC in London, the Soviet commissioner, Fyodor Gusev, was furious. He said the United States was awfully grabby for a country whose only troops in Europe were now stalled in Italy. In the Oval Office in April 1944, Roosevelt saw Wynat's counselor, George Kennan. Kennan was the American diplomat who would later become famous for his strategic thinking after World War II. The president told Kennan that he would not accept Churchill's plan to saddle him with the southern zone of Germany and the problems of post-war France. Kennan said he had come to discuss the boundary of the Soviet zone. He showed Roosevelt the plan drafted from his scratchings on the National Geographic map. The president laughed. He said, "Why, that's just something I once drew on the back of an envelope." He ordered Wynant to approve the British plan, with the exception of America being consigned to southern Germany. Wynant had another worry. The EAC had agreed on a three-power occupation of Berlin, which would be divided into three sectors. But no one had asked the Soviets to guarantee access rights across their zone to the city. Wynant was told by the State Department that Berlin should be no problem. Not only would the Soviets and the West be cooperating, but if the Soviets accepted Western rights to be present in post-war Berlin, naturally they must also acknowledge the right to travel to and from the city. The British agreed. In one of the great mistakes of modern diplomacy, Wynant was told not to raise the matter of access with the Russians because it might make them too suspicious. Nor did Roosevelt or Churchill ever consider the issue serious enough to take up with Stalin. After Tehran, Stalin pressed Roosevelt to soften his demand for unconditional surrender by Germany. As he planned his invasion of France, Eisenhower felt the same way. He asked both Roosevelt and Churchill to give some hope to the Germans that would weaken resistance when Anglo-American forces hit the beaches. But Churchill told Eisenhower that at Tehran, he and Roosevelt had agreed to let Russia seize a huge amount of German machinery after the war, and that Stalin wanted to take millions of Germans to help rebuild Russia. Therefore, he said, a frank statement of what is going to happen to Germany would not necessarily have a reassuring effect upon the German people. He said they might prefer the vaguer terrors of unconditional surrender. In March 1944, Admiral William Leahy of the Chiefs of Staff told Roosevelt that the Nazi gangsters in Berlin were telling Germans that their enemies intended their extermination. He said, "Couldn't the Allies issue a pledge that only German military aggression would be destroyed?" Roosevelt said that he was not willing to say that we do not intend to destroy the German nation as long as the German nation kept using the term Reich. He said that his somewhat long study and personal experience in and out of Germany made him believe that German philosophy cannot be changed by decree, law, or military order. He said it must be evolutionary, and that it might take two generations. Nevertheless, the president did not want to slam the door on Churchill or his chiefs. With the cross-channel invasion now planned for June 1944, he asked Churchill, "What would you think of a statement by me alone along these lines to be issued after D-Day?" He could declare that the Anglo-Americans sought the total destruction not of the German people, but of the philosophy of those Germans who have announced that they could subjugate the world. Churchill replied, "If there were nothing between us except that the Germans have an evil philosophy, there would be little ground for the war going on." Then, on June 6, 1944, the mighty Anglo-American armies landed on Hitler's Fortress Europe.
The Terrible Silence.
During the first 2 years that Americans fought the Germans, there was, at the center of Franklin Roosevelt's many private conversations about post-war Germany, a strange void. Throughout his fulminations against Junkers and Prussian militarism and the German love of marching and uniforms, he did not mention the biggest reason why any civilized human being of the 1940s should be uniquely anxious about the German national character. Franklin Roosevelt began receiving information as early as 1942 that Adolf Hitler, under a veil of secrecy, was carrying out his threats to annihilate the Jewish race. One might have expected the president to have gone on radio and told Americans in stirring language exactly what his government was learning about the Nazi death camps, adding that this unimaginable crime was exactly what the Allies were fighting to banish from the world. But Roosevelt made no such speech. In July 1942, the president of the American Jewish Congress, Rabbi Stephen Wise, asked the president for a statement that could be read to a Madison Square Garden rally against Hitler's oppression of Jews. In his statement, the president did not mention extermination or Jewish victims. Instead, his statement simply said that Americans sympathize with all victims of Nazi crimes and would hold the perpetrators to strict accountability in a day of reckoning which will surely come. In July 1943, at the White House, Lieutenant Jan Karski of the Polish Underground Army told Roosevelt about the mass murder of Jews he had witnessed taking place in a Polish concentration camp. He said, "Our underground authorities are absolutely sure that the Germans are out to exterminate the entire Jewish population of Europe." But when Karski implored Roosevelt to get the Allies to intervene, the president replied simply, "Tell your nation we shall win the war." There was something else. At the same time, in 1942 and 1943, Roosevelt was also unwilling to fight his own bureaucracy and hostile members of Congress to relax immigration restrictions that might help to rescue European Jews. Why did the president respond to the staggering news from Europe with near silence? Roosevelt felt he had a limited amount of influence with Stalin and Churchill and with Congress and the American people. The president was also doubtless sensitive to old complaints that his government, which some call the Jew deal, was too abundant with Jews, and that he had plotted to drag the nation into a Jewish war in Europe. Roosevelt never underestimated the anti-Semitism in American society. Before World War II, he had warned his ambassador to London, Joseph Kennedy, "If there was a demagogue around here of the type of Huey Long to take up anti-Semitism, there could be more blood running in the streets of New York than in Berlin." Roosevelt may also have felt that to dramatize Hitler's final solution and tell Americans this is what we're fighting against might divide them over what the war in Europe was really about, especially at a moment when it was not yet certain that the Allies would win the war in Europe. Roosevelt was the architect of modern interest group politics in America, and from his point of view, in 1942 and 1943, Jewish voters were in his hip pocket. And, with some conspicuous exceptions, the pressure from Jewish leaders to alleviate Jewish suffering in Europe was gentle. Many American Jews were reluctant to look like special pleaders during wartime. Widening Allied war aims to include the rescue of Europe's Jews would not have bothered Churchill. The Prime Minister was sporadically eager to take some risks to help the Jews. But what about Stalin? At that time, Roosevelt was using unconditional surrender as a means of keeping Stalin from growing too angry about his and Churchill's postponement of the D-Day invasion until mid-1944. Roosevelt might have felt that to depart from his promised single war aim could cause Stalin to distrust his intentions, especially if Stalin suspected that the sanction might be extended to all perpetrators of mass murder and genocide, namely Stalin. By the fall of 1943, a troubled Winston Churchill was searching for some way to halt the German atrocities. He hoped that as the Red Army started rolling back Nazi occupation, Europeans could be intimidated from joining in Hitler's atrocities, massacres, and executions. But at around the same time, Churchill's war cabinet resolved that the Allies should take final responsibility for punishing atrocities committed on enemy territory. Nevertheless, by November 1943, more than 3 million of Europe's Jews had perished. As Hitler's war against European Jewry raged on, Franklin Roosevelt maintained his silence. He would not spend his political coin on rescue and refugees. All of this undermined his lofty wartime premise that in planning for post-war Germany, he was confronting the most fundamental issues of German morality and German national character. Roosevelt might have argued in his defense that throwing all resources behind the single goal of an early Allied victory was the best way to save the Jews. Nevertheless, the more Hitler felt in danger of losing the war, the more the Nazi extermination mills were speeded up. As someone darkly observed at the time, by the moment the Allies won World War II in Europe, there might be no Jews left to save. By the end of 1943, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., Roosevelt's Secretary of the Treasury, Dutchess County neighbor, and closest friend in the cabinet, was deeply unsettled by the silence from the Oval Office. Morgenthau was so secular a Jew that although he was 52 years old, he had never attended a Passover Seder. During his decade at the Treasury, Roosevelt's friend had avoided Jewish matters. But the evidence from the death camps had radicalized him. When Rabbi Wise, who had celebrated Morgenthau's marriage to his wife Eleanor, brought him a cable from Switzerland and other information about how Hitler's Germans were murdering millions of Jews, Morgenthau had told him, "Please, Stephen, don't give me the gory details." Wise pressed on, explaining how the inmates' remains were being made into soap. He said, "The Nazis are making lampshades out of the skins of the Jews." As Morgenthau's confidential aide, Henrietta Klotz, recalled, her boss grew paler and paler. She said, "I thought he was going to keel over." Morgenthau cried out, "I cannot take any more."
The 100% American.
Henry Morgenthau's relationship with Franklin Roosevelt had been the lodestar not only of his public career, but to a great extent his identity. He once told an aide that his friendship with the president was the most important thing in his life. It was Roosevelt who, as governor of New York in 1929, had lifted Morgenthau from the obscurity of being the shy only son of a self-made New York real estate mogul. And it was the friendship with Roosevelt that gave Morgenthau a sense of personal acceptance and security as a Jew. As his elder son later put it, Morgenthau always wished to be thought of as a 100% American. Born in 1891, Henry Morgenthau, Jr. was descended from German Jews who were rabbis, cantors, Hebrew teachers, ritual slaughterers, and financiers. His paternal grandfather, Lazarus Morgenthau, came to post-Civil War America after suffering financial problems in Germany. The future Treasury Secretary spent much of his life differentiating himself from his vainglorious father. As a young man, Henry Jr. had suffered from a learning disability that made speaking and writing difficult. Miserable, he dropped out of Cornell. At his father's behest, he worked for a while as a timekeeper at a construction site, but soon he came down with typhoid fever. Sent to recuperate at a Texas ranch, the young Morgenthau discovered that what he really loved was farming. He returned to Cornell to study agriculture, and in 1913, at the age of 22, used part of his family money to buy a run-down 1,000-acre farm in East Fishkill, Dutchess County, New York. In 1916, Henry Jr. married Eleanor Fatman, granddaughter of a Lehman Brothers founder. She made up for what he lacked in ambition and sociability. While keeping an apartment in New York, they bought another 1,000 acres in Dutchess County to create Fishkill Farms, where in time they raised potatoes, cabbage, squash, rye, corn, beef cattle, apples, and in time 3 children, Henry III, Robert, and Joan. Life as a country squire gave Morgenthau distance from a father who, as Eleanor recalled, tried to regulate his life and dominate his thoughts. Franklin Roosevelt wasted no time in welcoming the new arrival to his home county. The two men both loved the land and styled themselves as farmers. Their wives became close friends. When the Morgenthaus came for tea at the Great House at Hyde Park, Roosevelt's mother Sarah wrote in her diary, "Young Morgenthau was easy and yet modest and serious and intelligent. The wife is very Jewish, but appeared very well." As an aspiring politician eager to be governor of New York and then president, Roosevelt knew that there would be political benefits in friendship with the young Morgenthau. In a state with so many Jewish voters, always prone to wonder whether some Christian candidate was privately anti-Semitic, it would be helpful for Roosevelt to have at least one close Jewish friend. Roosevelt came to call his friend Henry the Morgue, a playful jibe at Morgenthau's morbid countenance. He asked for his help in politics. For Morgenthau, his friendship with Roosevelt became something far more precious. Roosevelt was the older brother that Morgenthau never had, who abounded with the qualities he lacked: loquaciousness, extroversion, exuberance, self-confidence. Being embraced by a Hudson Valley patroon went a long way to quash any social inferiority the younger man felt, especially in a county not partial to Jews from New York City. And with his career hitched to Roosevelt's, the sky must have seemed the limit. Morgenthau tended the friendship as if it were one of his orchards. In this, he was guided by his shrewd and perceptive wife, whose friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt buttressed the tie between their husbands. Eleanor Morgenthau made herself politically useful by joining the women's division of the New York Democratic Party. Having shed the genteel anti-Semitism of her class, Mrs. Roosevelt took care to shield her Jewish friend from social slights. When Mrs. Morgenthau was blackballed from membership in the Elite Colony Club of New York, Mrs. Roosevelt resigned in protest. In 1938, Eleanor Morgenthau told the First Lady that she planned to give her daughter Joan a debutante party. Mrs. Roosevelt offered to have the affair at the White House. When the President was wheeled into the East Room, he kissed the young woman and said, "I'm sorry I cannot have the first dance with you." Guests who heard Roosevelt say this were in tears. When Roosevelt was elected president in 1932, Morgenthau hoped to be named Secretary of Agriculture, which would have made him only the second Jew in history to join a president's cabinet. But farm leaders in the Midwest and South scorned the idea of giving the job to a Jew and a New Yorker, despite New York State's considerable agriculture. Instead, Roosevelt made Morgenthau chairman of the Farm Credit Administration. Then, in the fall of 1933, Roosevelt's first Secretary of the Treasury, William Wooden, fell mortally ill. The president gave the job to his Hudson Valley friend. As Morgenthau recalled, when he heard the news, he broke out into a cold sweat. Fortune magazine dismissed the new Treasury Secretary as the son of a Jewish philanthropist who had spent most of his life farming. Others charged Roosevelt with cronyism. The New York Republican donor Gladys Strauss, herself Jewish, wisecracked that Roosevelt had managed to find the only Jew in the world who doesn't know a thing about money. But at that moment, Roosevelt's first demand of a Treasury Secretary was not expertise, but loyalty. That fall, Roosevelt had come close to breaking the law when he devalued the dollar by purchasing large quantities of gold. Indignant, the Undersecretary of the Treasury, Dean Acheson, had quit. But when he appointed Morgenthau, Roosevelt knew that he would never have to worry about his Treasury Secretary going off the reservation. Eager to establish his place in history, Morgenthau installed in his new Treasury office a recording system. It was activated by a button in his desk, and it captured his most important conversations and telephone calls. Morgenthau had a great advantage. He was the only cabinet member who had a personal relationship with the president. He was the only one who had a standing Monday lunch at the White House. Those who crossed him could never know what Morgenthau or his wife might say about them to the Roosevelts over family dinner at the White House or in Dutchess County. During cabinet meetings, Roosevelt and his friend passed silly notes to each other like schoolboys. Nevertheless, Morgenthau knew the hazards of depending on the mercurial Roosevelt. Years later, he recalled how the president played off one person against another. He recalled how Roosevelt never let anybody around him have complete assurance that he would have his job tomorrow. When Roosevelt smiled at him, Morgenthau was exuberant. When he ignored him, he was despondent. At the start of World War II, Roosevelt had flippantly raised Morgenthau's hopes by telling him, "You and I will run this war together." Then, like a jilted lover, Morgenthau watched mournfully as the president leaned instead on his rival Harry Hopkins, whom Roosevelt brought to the White House as a confidential wartime advisor. In 1938, after Hitler unleashed his pogrom against the Jews of Germany, Morgenthau had proposed that the United States acquire British and French Guiana as a haven for Jewish refugees in exchange for canceling the British and French World War I debt. But Roosevelt said no. He said, "It's no good. It would take the Jews 5 to 50 years to overcome the fever." Roosevelt did sound out the president of Paraguay about harboring Jewish refugees for money, and he asked Morgenthau for a list of the 1,000 richest Jews in the United States. But Morgenthau replied, "Before you talk about money, you have to have a plan." In November 1939, Rabbi Wise asked Morgenthau to intervene when the French were stopping Jewish refugees in French ports. Morgenthau replied that while his personal feelings would lead me to take an interest in the matter, he would stick to his rule that as Secretary of the Treasury, he would not do this kind of thing. Before World War II, whatever guilt Morgenthau might have felt about his reticence in helping save Jewish refugees from Hitler was sublimated in his zeal for defense preparedness and aid to Britain. More than most members of Roosevelt's cabinet, he was convinced that the United States would probably have to intervene in Europe. As Roosevelt's wartime Treasury Secretary, he helped to finance the costliest struggle in world history. In 1942, the Allies made Admiral Jean Darlan of the Vichy French regime, which was collaborating with the Nazis, High Commissioner of North Africa. It was a wildly controversial deal to keep French troops from opposing their invasion. When Darlan began enforcing Nazi decrees, Morgenthau complained to the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson. He said Darlan had sold many thousands of people into slavery. Unlike many other American officials, Morgenthau refused to separate the German people from their evil government. He was an original believer in collective guilt for German war crimes. Throughout his life, Morgenthau had suffered splitting migraine headaches and spasms of nausea, forcing him to stretch out for hours and days in a dark room. What he learned in 1942 and 1943 from Rabbi Wise and others about the death camps of Europe disturbed his sleep more than ever. Henrietta Klotz, who worshipped Morgenthau while serving him for more than 20 years, hectored her boss about the Jews of Europe. With ash blonde hair and blazing blue eyes, Mrs. Klotz had grown up poor in an Orthodox Jewish household. She later said she was the key to getting him interested in Jewish things. As Klotz's husband Herman recalled, she told Morgenthau, with much prodding, pressure, and unpleasantness, that he must go over to the White House and get the president to take some action that would minimize the killing of the Jews. Three Treasury lawyers, John Paley, Randolph Paul, and Josiah Dubois, all Christians, told Morgenthau that Assistant Secretary of State Breckinridge Long, who was hostile to foreigners, especially Jews, had been deliberately obstructing the flow of money, information, and passports that might save Jews from Hitler. The State Department had also blocked efforts to find refuge for Jews in the United States, Turkey, Switzerland, and Palestine. Morgenthau was furious. In December of 1943, he arranged a showdown with Long. He said, "Breck, we might be a little frank. The impression is all around that you particularly are anti-Semitic." Long denied it. Morgenthau went on. He said, "Breck, the United States of America was created as a refuge for people who were persecuted the world over, starting with Plymouth. And as Secretary of the Treasury for 135 million people, I am carrying this out as Secretary of the Treasury and not as a Jew." This was not something Morgenthau might have said even a year earlier. Long's boss, Cordell Hull, was little more willing to expend himself to save Jews. One reason was that he was inclined to back career State Department men like Long. Another reason was more personal. Few people knew it, but Hull's wife was half-Jewish. As the historian Erwin Gelman has written, Hull consciously turned away from the refugee question, worried that anti-Semites would argue that his wife had forced him to support Jewish causes. Most of Hull's friends tiptoed around the subject of his wife's Jewish heritage, but by now Morgenthau had no patience for niceties. He bluntly told Hull, "If you were a member of the cabinet in Germany today, you would be most likely in a prison camp, and your wife would be God knows where." Morgenthau was pained to find General Eisenhower's attitude toward refugees no different from that of the British, namely that this thing is a damn nuisance. Since the start of the war, Morgenthau had quietly and cautiously tried to help Jewish refugees. But after he learned the full truth about the Nazi death factories and how Long and others had slammed the door on the possibility that the doomed Jews of Europe might somehow be saved, something in Morgenthau snapped. Whatever the reason for his transformation, this was the supreme moment of his career. If going to Roosevelt made the president think of Morgenthau as a special petitioner for his fellow Jews, so it would have to be. Morgenthau made an appointment with the president for a Sunday in mid-January 1944. He decided to take along a slightly toned-down version of a document given him by his aides. It was called "Report to the Secretary on the Acquiescence of This Government in the Murder of the Jews." The report began somberly. It said, "One of the greatest crimes in history, the slaughter of the Jewish people, is continuing unabated."